This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Twitter and Facebook, of course, have revolutionized how information is spread. And even health officials are relying on social media to pass on science and health news. The CDC, for instance, tweets several times a day. So does North Carolina's Health and Human Services Department. But what catches on and who is engaging with all those ideas? Brian Southwell may have an answer. He's the author of Social Networks and Popular Understanding of Science and Health, Sharing Disparities. Brian works at RTI International, and he teaches at Duke University and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and joins us now. Brian, welcome. Good to have you here.
Great. I greatly appreciate your interest, Frank.
Well, and to focus this and give us a sense of what this is about, I want to take a look at something you wrote about in the book, the Twitter debate over the swine flu pandemic.
Sure.
In 2009. So what correlation did researchers find between that conversation and flu vaccine?
Right. It's a great example to start because what they found was that there was actually correspondence between what people tended to tweet about and the actual patterns of vaccination in the area where they lived. And so this really paralleled something we've seen more broadly, just this polarization of the country and the idea that not everybody's talking about the same thing. And that's a really important part of this.
So there were big disparities from one place
Absolutely.
To another, and they correlated closely with who's talking about it. So that's the one thing. I mean, maybe if you're encouraging people to be vaccinated, mm-hmm. would be nice to know they tweet about it and up the up the population. On the other hand, if there's bad information out there, then you sort of have to live with that too.
Absolutely. This is another dynamic that we're certainly aware of, but it's part of entering into this arena and encouraging people to talk is that the spread of misinformation is rife. And we see this happen quite a bit. And it's now facilitated by contemporary technology. But the spread of rumors has been with us for quite some time.
All right. So this would suggest that maybe if you're in a health department, you would certainly turn to social media. You know a lot more people are on it. So if I want to get the word out, and we're sitting at our meeting talking about outreach, somebody says, don't forget social media, and we push our message that way.
Absolutely. And certainly as part of the toolkit, that makes some sense. One of the things I was compelled by, though, one of the reasons I wrote the book was that increasingly I'm seeing colleagues and others get excited about social networks, leveraging social networks, about social media and all the promise and potential. And at the end of the day, I think that it's not sufficient to rely there, and that we may, in fact, actually end up reifying or hardening some disparities between people in doing that. So there's some things that we need to take account of and be careful of before we just turn to this wholesale as a new the new way to reach out to the population.
Well, tell me more about this reinforcing the disparities that are already there if we rely more on social media.
At the end of the day, we're not all equally connected. And I think that's something that's really important. It's really easy to lose sight of because we're surrounded by folks, and we hear these echo chambers. We social interaction is a part of our everyday life. But at the same time, not everybody shares the same size network, and certainly not everybody's equally likely to talk about various topics. In fact, not only are we constrained in terms of these differences between us in terms of the size of our networks, but not all topics are equally likely to get talked about. A great example of this, and something that really inspired me a bit while I was putting the book together, came during the fall about a year or so ago when we had a hurricane, or I guess Superstorm Sandy. And I'm originally from upstate New York, and folks and my friends and family, we're talking a bit about preparedness and the after effects of the storm. There was a little bit of a discussion, not much, about the science of the storm. There could have been more there. And you might assume on the basis of that Twitter was ablaze with discussion about Sandy. Well, in the days following landfall, actually trending topics were things like Disney's acquisition of the Star Wars franchise. And I know that the Force is strong with Yoda, but there was really there were more important topics that could have been discussed, and that's partly human nature, and that's something that I like to point out in the book. So that's the possibility for people engaging with these topics that we think that they will just by virtue of putting them out there and hoping it's going to spread virally. I think is maybe a bit of a mistake to assume that.
So if you're the health department or transportation department and you're trying to get the word out and you notice in the advance everybody's on Twitter, pay attention, because the minute the storm passes, their attention is going to shift. find another way, or just include that. Make sure it's only part of the toolkit. Mm-hmm. And there was a Harvard study that looked at people displaced by Hurricane Katrina. And there again, it's not necessarily your digital connections, but just how social networks work. Right?
You know, that's another great example. And actually, you know, one thing that I've noticed in kind of putting together and thinking about social networks is that certainly Facebook and social media are a prominent example, but there's a whole lot to talk about just in terms of our everyday interactions with people. And again, going back to that point that some of us are more well-connected than others, the folks at Harvard looked at folks who had been displaced in that situation from New Orleans and Houston later on. And they looked at how people got information. And as it turns out, a lot of the people that ended up having to be evacuated in an emergency way later on simply hadn't heard from friends or family much information. We thought we all were hearing a whole lot. And yet there were a lot of folks that were off the radar, more marginalized. And for many of those folks, they were missing out on potentially life-saving information just by virtue of the fact that they were less well-connected. And so that's something that I think we really need to keep in mind.
Less well-connected generally, it doesn't necessarily whether or not they were on Twitter or had some kind of social network, it means there were fewer people in their lives, or suggests that.
Absolutely. And so you think about this in terms of the earnest, well-intentioned efforts that many of us are pursuing. And I'm certainly far from a Luddite. I think there are great possibilities with social media. But even here locally, there's been some debate as to the DHHS's recent decision to engage in public discussion with regards to mental health policy by virtue of holding a Twitter town forum. And a perfectly well-intentioned effort. But I think one can raise questions as to whether everybody who could have been potentially at the table in having that discussion was reached by Twitter. And I think that's kind of encapsulates in a nutshell some of the dynamics that we're talking about.
Right. So it's, on the one hand, if you took that information from the Twitter town forum, town hall, and you said, all right, well, here's one piece of it. Now let's add it to other, sort of local forums. We're going to go into these communities. We're going to ask, knock on doors. That would be one thing. But if you rely on that and say, hey, we did this thing and here's what people say we should do for mental health in North Carolina, you've really missed a lot of people.
I would agree with that, yeah.
And you also – you looked at a refer a friend program in Minnesota as well that shines light on this. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, that's another great example of some of the really innovative work that people try to engage in terms of engaging and leveraging social networks. But it doesn't always go exactly as planned. And in that particular instance, colleagues at the Minnesota Department of Health were engaged in a really a great program overall to try to provide cancer screening for the underinsured and uninsured populations in Minnesota. And they employed a refer-a-friend program. And in that instance, folks who had participated in screening were able to nominate friends and family to also come in and get screened. And they thought this was a way of reaching additional people. And at the end of the day, more people were reached. But we also found out that those folks who were most well-connected, that were socioeconomically most well off, were the ones who tended to take advantage of that program. And so you could argue that we maybe didn't necessarily do everything possible to reach those that were truly marginalized and possibly even reified some disparities along the way. So it's this double-edged sword. And it's something that I think we don't need to back away altogether from using social media. We have to recognize some of these dynamics in rushing headlong into using this.
If you talk about reinforcing inequalities, are there correlations? Are there racial, other demographic and income correlations as well? Who's connected, who's not?
What's really fascinating in looking at this, Frank, is that it's not as though – I mean, we all talk to each other. Most people have the benefit of having some friends or family. And so day in, day out, I'd hesitate to suggest that there are demographic differences in terms of just simple interaction per se. That said, we do find that for some specialized topics, there are important differences. One of the primary ones that we found – I did some work back at the University of Minnesota with some graduate students in which we looked at the degree to which you could get people talking about public service announcements with regards to climate change, with regards to transportation policy. And we did find that there were differences according to educational background and such that folks that had a lot of formal educational training maybe are practiced at talking about these types of things. And we find that confidence, background knowledge, all of that matters. And it's one of the reasons why around the Thanksgiving table, you may not see all the conversations that could happen because people aren't sure. Not only are they not necessarily certain themselves about particular topics, but they aren't sure about their conversational partners and how much interest they might have or background knowledge. So it does seem to be the case that there is some correspondence with education. In terms of other, you know, demographic factors, different groups tend to talk about lots of different things in their everyday life. And so but whether or not it's the intricacies of health policy or nanoscience, those are open questions.
So that may be why you're pushing out stories about Disney and Disney takeovers, because you're sure that everybody in your network is going to care about that. You've heard that kind of conversation before. The other ones, maybe not. They won't catch on.
Absolutely. Anybody that's in the business of communication is used to thinking about a lowest common denominator, used to thinking about those places where you might connect with an audience. And sometimes taking chances to reach into new areas, that's difficult. So we wouldn't expect that people individually would necessarily do that in their everyday life over the water cooler or by email or on Facebook either.
Not on this show, Brian. No lowest common denominator on this show. We have raised the bar.
Absolutely.
And let's talk about this from the other side, because essentially we've been talking about pushing the message. We've been talking about outreach. But there seems to me a way that you could use social media and networking to gather information, to find out what other people are – sort of a ground-up approach.
I think that that's right. I do think that there are great possibilities for monitoring, the pulse of what's out there. That said, we could probably take a misstep in assuming that that's all that people are interested in, again, for some of the reasons that we've talked about. But I do think that there are these great possibilities, technological tools to monitor, the pulse of the nation. And that's something that we ought to be, engaged in. And again, it's a complex picture. I'd hate to have people think that I'm arguing against, engagement of these everyday interactions. It's just that they aren't necessarily representative of everything that's possible in reaching out to
right.
people.
Right. It's just how much attention you're going to pay to it, and how much importance you attach, and
that's right.
whether or not it's part of something larger. We didn't talk too much about this, and I want to talk some more about what happens with emotionally charged issues, particularly when it comes to science. I know if you think about the relationship between vaccines and autism, the minute you mention that, it becomes a polarizing kind of question.
Right. No, and it's really useful for you to raise that, because there certainly are topics in the scientific sphere, in the health arena, that people do talk about, that they do share information about. In the scientific arena, pictures from the Hubble Space Telescope that are really dramatic, sometimes they're awe-inspiring. You'll see those, passed along. Certainly, some of the debates that we've had, focused on vaccine and autism are a great example. There's quite a bit that can be found, online with regards to that. People don't necessarily talk about more mundane aspects, though. We might think about topics that affect a much larger number of people, heart health, for example, and basic science with regards to that. And one of the findings has been that both concise information and emotionally charged information seems much more likely to spread. And so that makes sense. It makes sense from even an evolutionary perspective that we'd pay attention to those things in the environment that seem to be energized and that are causing others dismay or great warmth or happiness. But at the end of the day, that means that we're going to miss out talking on some topics. You might think about the drier aspects of what we talk about here and how much of that might get referred or passed along. And maybe not much of it would. But imagine that an intern brought in a kitten and it disrupted our conversation and we were chasing around the studio. Chances are that would probably go viral, right? And so those are things that you're right to point out, that there are really important differences in what spreads.
But there's a contradiction in that in some ways, because the emotionally charged issues are the ones that are going to get our attention and be probably paid most attention to. On the other hand, didn't we say earlier that when you're not certain about your interest in a topic or even where you stand on a topic, that's when we become a little less likely to push it out?
That's a great point. And I do think that there is the constraint of taboo, the constraint of social norms that that really do probably tamp down some discussion, unless you're really comfortable that those in your network and echo chamber are going to share the perspective that you have. And so it's difficult sometimes to take a chance on talking about a health-related issue. Imagine discussions that we might have around HIV or AIDS or the plight of the homeless or other topics that you're not necessarily certain how others are going to react to. And you might be less likely to click share on Facebook when those things come along.
What about the public consciousness over tobacco and heart disease? That's something that you've had a chance to study a little.
Well, you know, those are good examples of instances where a combination of broadcast information and over time people's interactions that we've reached a collective sense of, awareness of these larger health issues. So something like, heart disease or, links between tobacco and cancer. Over decades, that information diffuses. It's not only in the news and in popular culture, but you also have everyday, experience. And I do think that sort of the slow trickle, there are instances where, it is possible for networks to certainly play a reinforcing role, in the overall diffusion equation.
And then there's the silo effect. If you go back to days when all you had was a public service announcement to push your message, that was the largest way to the fastest way to reach a mass audience.
Right.
You had three networks, so everybody was watching. Where a third of America was watching, and now you have these siloed.
Right. Well, the fragmentation of the media landscape is something that is part of the reason why I think folks get excited. They're kind of grasping at this possibility of engagement with large numbers again. But when it comes to social media, there's really something important to keep in mind. You consider something like Facebook, and so you've got roughly, conservatively, a billion monthly users, and that's great. But that means at the end of the day that still, the majority of the world isn't on Facebook. And second, I can't, as an individual person, have any realistic expectation that if I were to go home today and to post something, that I'm going to reach a billion people. I just don't have that many friends. And I'm okay with that. That's all right. But nonetheless, we think about these new media phenomenon, social media phenomenon, but individually, they're not quite reaching the large numbers. So, but even more generally, you're right. We don't have the same media landscape that we used to. And so it's increasingly difficult. We need innovation in trying to find ways to share and reach large groups of people. And people that are doing that work, more power to them. It's really important work. It's just there's some nuances along the way that we ought to attend to.
Thank you for sharing them with us, Brian. Good to have you on the program. Brian Southwell's new book is called Social Networks and Popular Understanding of Science and Health, Sharing Disparities. He works at RTI International, teaches at Duke and UNC, and you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Nicole Campbell, Alex Granados, Laura Lee, and Sean Wen. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, the news director. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.